to Straight Talk with MJ. I'm your host, Michelle Jeanette. Thank you for joining me on another episode. And today is the 12th of June. Again, time is flying by so fast. I'm going to get right into it because I'm trying to shorten my podcast down a little bit so people can listen and not take all day to hear it. So today's topic is time to run. What does that mean? Time to run, get in shape? maybe. What are we doing? Time to run away? Or maybe time to run towards something. So I'm going to share a few things. If you hear my dog in the background, she's looking out the window as I record this right now. Probably seeing a cat next door. But time to run towards something, right? So a lot of things going on. I want to share some encouraging stories, but start with something very important that maybe you've heard about it, maybe you haven't, or maybe you don't know what it actually is. But before I get into CRT, maybe you know what that is. I'm trying to get more and more episodes to you guys, but if you remember, I had an episode back in April where I had extremely bad inner ear vertigo equilibrium problem where I was in bed for like 2 weeks. I couldn't do anything. And my husband's like, I had to take care of her for 2 whole weeks. He did a good job. Thank you very much. But I'm having some residual issues with that, and it affects me. I'm going to physical therapy. It's kind of interesting how they can do physical therapy with your eyes. They found out it was something with my inner ear, my equilibrium, not connecting with my eyes and my inner ear and my what my brain is telling my eyes to do. So they do these exercises or something. I hope they work because I'm really tired of being... It gets frustrating because I do a lot of reading to... you know, for research for my podcast, and it makes me ill when I do that. So, I'm trying to get more out podcast episodes, but I have to take my time on this because I can't read a whole lot at a time. Anyway, so, just letting you all know why I'm not bringing out as many to you guys right now. I'm trying to at least do once a week right now. So time to run. What does that exactly mean? So, first of all, I love what I'm going to end with is something so inspirational. That's how I like to end, want to end it with that before I do my history part. From the Lieutenant Governor of North Carolina, he had a speech and it was so really powerful. But the history of America and Americans, they're pretty determined people. They don't back down. The history of us is that we don't back down. We don't run away from trouble is what, the North Carolina Lieutenant Governor was saying. And so, but lately it seems like we just kind of, fell asleep at the wheel, so to speak. Especially, and I address this as a Christian, especially as Christians in the church, we tend to shy away from anything controversial or that's conflict. We're supposed to love one another, right? So I'm going to read two articles. The first one is going to explain what's going on especially in the education and the school system, what they're trying to push, and in our military, what they're trying to push in our military. It's outrageous. It's Marxist. And if you don't know what that means, let me read this article to you, and maybe it'll help you really fully understand what this means. This is article out of the AmericanConservative.com under education, Lessons in Critical Race Theory from Behind the Iron Curtain. So this author is from Hungary. This was dated June 10th. The author is Stephen. So when, I'm quoting here, when I graduated from the Loudoun County Public School System, I believe that's in Virginia, 7 years ago, LCPS was known as one of the best in the country and it deserved that title. The schools I attended were in excellent conditions and the teachers were compassionate and well-educated, and students were given the best space possible in which to achieve. With regards to politics, I remember my school as very neutral, if not a little conservative. John Oliver once lambasted the material used in my school's abstinence-only curriculum. Thus, it came as a surprise when LCPS broke out into the news as the epicenter of the critical race theory or critical racism theory, CRT, war raging throughout the U.S. This seemingly new curriculum, which politicizes the classroom and trains young people to view their society and history through an explicitly race-based and confrontational lens, has rightfully upset scores of parents of various races, creeds, and backgrounds and caused them to protest, as they did in Loudoun County, against this curricula. What is most worrying to me is that a critical race theory-based curriculum is only new in an American sense. As a researcher studying the legacy of communism in Europe, currently based in Budapest, Hungary, I was unsettled to find the CRT curriculum strikingly similar to the education policy of the Communist Party that ruled Hungary during the Cold War, and of course, China. When the Soviet Union overthrew Hungary's nascent democracy in the late 1940s and installed Marxist-Leninist policies, education was one of the areas of foremost concern for the party. Gotta get the kids while they're young, right? The new communist leaders, knowing that they had little support among the Hungarian population, strove to indoctrinate and convert the Hungarian people through education. If you notice, that's what happens today. The radicals on the left know that their agenda won't pass average American, normal American people. The majority of American people don't like their policies. So they have to get them in school and get them into the curriculum, and then they use legislation. Right now we're just seeing all kinds of crazy communist type legislation trying to be pushed upon the people. Anyway, side note. Like CRT, the communist education system was based on impressing to students that their society, in particular their history, was nothing more than a story of oppressors and victims. Instead of race, however, this system of oppression, according to the Marxist dogma, was based on class, property, and religion. Peasants and industrial workers were glorified as noble victims of an oppressive system orchestrated by the aristocrats, the kulaks, which were peasants who owned slightly more land, religion, and the intelligentsia. By understanding this oppression, the communist leaders hoped the youths would be transformed into what they commonly called the communist man. This ideal state being achieved through education differs only slightly from CRT's aim to create the anti-racist. Both are created by instilling a political sense of morality based on an understanding society as an oppressive structure and fighting against it. So he goes on and talks about all the work in the school in the 1923 Soviet law on education, all the work in the school and the whole organization of school life should promote proletarian class consciousness in the minds of pupils and create knowledge of the solidarity of labor in its struggle with capital. A simple find and replace could turn this into any CRT curriculum. Quote, all the work in the school and the whole organization of school life should promote equitable racial consciousness in the minds of pupils and create knowledge of the solidarity of non-whites in their struggle with racism. See how they replace just a few words? Same thought. One does not have to go through this much effort, however, to make the connection. When looking through CRT material, you will find phrases like raising race consciousness and standing in solidarity riddled throughout. The handy Racial Healing Handbook by Annalise Singh uses strikingly similar language in describing the anti-racist. Quote, The term anti-racist refers to people who are actively seeking not only to raise their consciousness about race and racism, but also to take action when they see racial power inequities in everyday life, end quote. Now, of course, this is me saying this. None of us, I wasn't raised, you know, I was raised as a Christian, and especially as American and a Christian, that everyone is equal in the eyes of the Lord. And so that's how I treat people. I treat them equally, and like we all should, based, you know, you look at a man based on the content of their character, who they are, not what they look like or their skin color. That's how I was raised, and a lot of people that I know that were raised that way. A majority of Americans, you know, in my age, were raised that way. That's, you know, we've overcome a lot of things in America. That's the joy, that's the beauty of America and Americans, is you keep moving forward and overcome things. And instead of moving backwards and trying to implement this division based on racism and what they're doing and saying that whites, if you are white, you are automatically the oppressor, that in itself is racism. So it's pretty ironic. Another curious similarity between these two education systems is their blatant, unequal treatment of people for the sake of equity. When it came to higher education, the communists based their admission system on Hungary's pre-communist class system. Peasants and industrial workers were given preferential treatment, while the children of kulaks and religious families and aristocrats, or any other privileged class, faced a much tougher admission process. We're seeing the same thing happen today. If you're white, especially male white, and conservative, you are at the bottom of the rung right now. So this reverse discrimination led to many of the same problems we have in our higher education system in the United States, such as qualified candidates being denied admission, and most notably, a widespread fabrication of one's background. So another cornerstone of the communist education system was the subordination of all subjects to the oppressor-victim narrative. And you're hearing that all across the board right now. So this is Marxist-based ideology indoctrinating our children to think and look at each other on the base of skin color. And that the white skin is always the oppressor, and any other skin color is the oppressed. And you're always a victim if you're any other skin color than white. And you can never overcome. And you can never, there's never any reconciliation. There's never any come together unity. There's no forgiveness. There's nothing of that. And that is so far away from what Christians should be believing in. We shouldn't even be touching CRT and supporting it in any shape, fashion, or matter, or form. And it's infiltrating our churches, even, you know, in this whole guise of being equity. You know, equality is you know, you have equality opportunities. Equity means they're trying to make outcome the same, not opportunity. And that's not how it works. That is not freedom at all. So this other article I found is, wow, it was so powerful. It's called Politics is Interested in You, by Nathan Fisher, and this is on AmericanMind.org. And there's no hiding from the left and hoping they'll go away. And this is sort of how we've come out of the last decade or so, couple decades, because we're living our lives, and especially I look at from a Christian perspective, you know, we're just focused on loving others, which is not a bad thing. Don't get me wrong. That's not a bad thing. Loving others and loving God. We're called to do that as Christians. But there's a little more to it, especially those of us who live in a constitutional republic. We have a duty if we live in a constitutional republic, which is what our founders established. It does not work without the citizen. it's not like a king and queen and they rule the land and we have no say in the matter. This is a constitutional republic. The supreme law of the land is the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, our founding documents. We have three branches of government. They're not equal. Some are more important than others, legislative being the most important. But this constitutional republic does not work without a moral, a religious, and a knowledgeable citizen. And we've kind of stepped away from that. So this is, I found this article and it was spot on. So I wanted to read this to you. You may not be interested in politics, but politics is interested in you. Can't get away from it. Many Americans focused on their businesses, careers, home, and family, and I say church, prefer to ignore the political battles and attendant controversy dividing our country. But neutrality is no longer an option. We're at a point right now, this is me speaking, we don't have an option of just sitting this out. We have to do something. We have to take action, like Steve Bannon always says. So Alex de Tocqueville wrote about Americans' love of being left alone. He called it individualism, and he fretted that one of the risks to our experiment in self-government was the tendency to retreat from questions concerning the public political questions. Hold on, let me see what she's looking at here. She thought that was Rich pulling in the driveway and got excited, but it was not. So sorry about that. Continuing on with the article. Alex de Tocqueville called it individualism, and he fretted that one of the risks to our experiment in self-government was the tendency to retreat from questions concerning the public, political questions, in favor of enjoying our private lives. Yeah, that's probably a natural thing. The risk he recognized was that retreating would enable subversion of the whole polity by people manipulating it for their own gain. Sound familiar? Our society has morphed away from anything recognizable even 10 years ago. For many, politics was always something away from home, away from daily life. It was somewhere else, often relevant mostly to small things like marginal differences in a tax bill. Yeah, wasn't a huge difference. Not anymore. A corrosive trend has developed. As some become increasingly political and demanding, the cost for others of expressing an opinion or even ignoring the wrong activist demand has grown intolerably high. This distorts the public debate, giving the illusion that a vocal group of ideologues is representative of the mainstream. Yeah, especially when the media is the mouthpiece for these radical leftist ideologues. That's all you hear. Because the mainstream has been intimidated into silence. And as more mainstream Americans find themselves in a country they don't recognize, they are realizing that remaining apolitical was a luxury of another time. Political fanatics take advantage of normal people who try to play it down the middle. This holds true in ordinary businesses in middle America, in elite liberal arts colleges, and in the New York Times newsroom. Many people would rather go about their work and ignore the political battles that increasingly divide our country. But the left will not leave you this option. In the workplace, woke ideologues politicize ordinary activities, conversations, and speech. They compel employers, suppliers, partners, and advertisers to bend to their demands. They are intrusive and uncompromising. Even a rejection of politics is treated as political. Two companies that took the unusual step of banning workplace politics, Coinbase and Basecamp, received sharp media backlash and had numerous employees resign, outraged that their employer would no longer indulge their activism. You will have no choice but to take a side. The cultural and institutional power of the left makes it the path of least resistance. This starts with seemingly anodyne acts like rainbow flags superimposed on logos, Black Lives Matter window signs, and last year when all this was going on and all the riots were happening and started in Minneapolis, my husband and I went and worked a hailstorm in Minneapolis, just outside of Minneapolis. And we went into a lot of these suburbs, neighborhoods to work the claims. And you'd see Black Lives Matter signs in all the yards, like a majority of the yards. And we were in predominant, I mean, it was mixed neighborhoods, but a lot of it was middle, upper class neighborhoods. And so it was not just Black, it was a lot of middle class white people. And I hate labeling people like that, but this is why I'm trying to make a point. So one of our friends asked a person, why do you have that in your yard? He said, because they come knocking door to door, the BLM people come knocking door to door, and they pretty much tell you, you're going to put this in your yard. And he said that a person across the street said, no, thank you. And I'm not saying this was causation or related, but this is what happened. This is what the person told him. The homeowner told him. And he said it wasn't a few days later that home got broken into. They did not have the BLM sign in their yard. So pretty much it was intimidation. You know, so it's not like everybody is for BLM, which is, again, why? If their message is so great, why do they have to force people to have signs in their yard? Just a question. I want you to be able to question things. We can't do that anymore. We can't question things. If we ask the wrong, quote unquote, wrong question, or if we question their motives, you know, you pretty much get crucified socially. Anyway, back to this article. These demands are not just marginal cost, a woke tax of sorts that lets you otherwise run your business as you like. Rather, they will stifle dynamism, drive away free thinking employees, and alienate half of America's population who will choose alternatives as these arise. Skipped a part, my bad. So it talked about Black Lives Matter, window signs, small donations to activist organizations, more substantive demands follow, such as diversity quotas, mandatory pronoun announcements, changes in hiring standards, and, quote, anti-racism training sessions. This is happening in businesses all over. These are still rationalized on business grounds, such as claims they uncover undervalued talent and improve team cohesion. How do you improve team cohesion by claiming one person who's white is the oppressor and anybody else is the oppressed? That does not build unity. So, many of these demands, even if initially tempered or covered in management-friendly veneer, are designed to subvert the market system on which businesses are built. They are based on precepts of critical theory that are fundamentally opposed to the market system. There is a better path, okay? You must reject woke demands, refuse to make even token gestures, and invest instead in relationships and partnerships with people and organizations who have likewise steeled themselves against the mob's oppression. I can't say this word. Anyway, the sooner you make this decision, the less disruptive it will be. You'll lose fewer employees and customers, have made fewer difficult to reverse organizational decisions, and done less to bend your brand and culture to fit the woke narrative. Most importantly, you'll have more friends to stand by your side as you face the inevitable slander and attacks, because this path will not be easy either. The left will try to use their power to punish you. When the mob comes for you, they will not simply target you. They may place immense pressure on junior people in your company or even family members of junior people in organizations that so much as associate with you. They may call you racist and accuse you of harassment. They may use government agencies to impede your permit applications and launch investigations based on the lies of your enemies. Companies, especially banks and others in regulated industries, may hesitate to do business with you because they fear negative attention from ginned-up PR campaigns. There is no escaping the political conflict we face, but you can at least side with those who are not committed to destroying your way of life. This is where the American spirit comes in. You stand up against this kind of destruction. This is not unifying. This is destruction. Okay, this is the tearing down of family, the nuclear family, the capitalism, free market system, and it's ushering in Marxism and socialism, which is two classes, the rich and elite and the poor. Everybody, the middle class gets erased. I mean, just look at the one of the founders of BLM, Patrice. I think her name was Patrice. She bought 3 multi-million dollar homes recently. She just put up a fence around one of them. A fence, because they can put a fence around their home, but not at the border. That's a whole other show. This invasion at the border that this regime is allowing to happen. It's all kind of coordinated. We're getting attacked on multiple fronts. And so we can't sit and be quiet. We can't. Or you're not going to have, I'm just saying, you're not going to have the America that I grew up loving. The freedoms, the constitutional republic. It won't make it. It's up to us. So whether you publicly and explicitly side with the political right or simply reject the demands of ideological activists, the woke mobs will treat you as their enemy. Your friends, those who will continue to do business with you despite the attacks this may also bring them, will be others who have chosen to side against the left, especially those who have publicly stood firm. Act accordingly. Show these people the loyalty you want them to show you. When they are attacked, resist pressure to distance yourself from them, even if you have not yet faced similar attacks. We may all face this mob, and we must stand together. The political left dominates public discourse and has driven many legacy institutions to endorse its side, but as more people and businesses publicly refuse to cave to their demands, the limits of their power will become clear. We are organizing the other side. You are not alone. There is a vibrant and growing group of people committed to a better vision. So now I'm going to show 3 examples of some of these people that are speaking up and not being quiet. And this is what I wanted. I wanted to inspire you because we can't be quiet anymore. Like my husband and I, we went to the local school board meeting the other night. And we live in a state where it's very conservative. And we live in a county, one of the most conservative counties in our state. I think it was probably 80% or more are conservative in this county. So when you have that kind of majority, you tend to get a little lackadaisical about getting involved. So anyway, we went to the school board meeting. It was interesting. There weren't a lot of people there. It's June. But in your cities and stuff, there are parents speaking out against this kind of CRT and the destruction of our, you know, our schools and our education system. So I wanted to share a couple of those with you. Let's see. Hold on. Okay, this first one is a mom who is from China, and her family escaped the Cultural Revolution in Mao's China. And they came here, and she spoke out at a school board meeting in Loudoun County, which is Virginia. So listen to this. What she has to say is powerful.
I've been very alarmed about what's going on in our school. You are now teaching, training our children to be social justice warriors and to loathe our country and our history. Growing up in Mao's China, all this seemed very familiar. The communist regime used the same critical theory to divide people. The only difference is they use class instead of race. During the Cultural Revolution, I witnessed students and teachers turn against each other We changed school names to be politically correct. We were taught to denounce our heritage. The Red Guards destroy anything that is not communist, old statues, books, and anything else. We are also encouraged to report on each other, just like the Student Equity Ambassador Program and the Bias Reporting System. This is indeed the American version of the Chinese Cultural Revolution. The critical race theory has its roots in cultural Marxism. It should have no place in our schools.
Ooh, I tried to, I don't know if you could hear that. She was saying, let's see if I said it. She said to me and to a lot of Chinese, it is heartbreaking that we escaped communism and now we experience communism here. And she's saying that it's just like back in China. And this is happening here. It's to divide people. It looks just like what happened there. She said, we were taught to denounce our heritage and Red Guards destroyed anything that is not communist, statues, books, and everything else. We are also encouraged to report on each other, just like the Student Equity Ambassador Program and the Bias Reporting System. This is indeed the American version of the Chinese Cultural Revolution. The critical race theory has its roots in cultural Marxism. It should have no place in our school. That's what she was saying. She would know. They came from that. Okay, the next one is a young black mother in, her name's Keisha Keen, to the State Board of Education, and listen to what she has to say.
My name is Keisha King. I'm a mom of two, one who's in the Duval County Public School System and one in private school thanks to school choice. I'm also a member of Moms for Liberty, representing thousands of parents. Just coming off of May 31st, marking the 100 years of the Tulsa riots, it is sad that we are even contemplating something like critical race theory, where children will be separated by their skin color and deemed permanently oppressors or oppressed in 2021. That is not teaching the truth, unless you believe that whites are better than blacks. I have personally heard teachers teaching CRT, and we have had an assembly shut down because Duval County Public School System consultant thought it would be a great idea to separate students by race. This is unacceptable. CRT is not racial sensitivity or simply teaching unfavorable American history or teaching Jim Crow history. CRT is deeper and more dangerous than that. CRT, in its outworking today, is a teaching that there is a hierarchy in society where white, male, heterosexual, able-bodied people are deemed the oppressor, and anyone else outside of that status is oppressed. That's why we see corporations like Coca-Cola asking their employees to be less white, which is ridiculous. I don't know about you, but telling my child or any child that they are in a permanent oppressed status in America because they are black is racist, and saying that white people are automatically above me, my children, or any child is racist as well. This is not something that we can stand for in our country. And don't take it from me, look at the writers of these types of publications. Our ancestors, white, black, and others, hung, bled, and died right alongside each other to push America towards that more perfect union. If this continues, we will look back and be responsible for the dismantling of the greatest country in the world by reverting to teaching hate and that race is a determining factor on where your destiny lies. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Woo, that was a good one. That was a real good one. Sorry about my dog again. She is looking out the window. Okay, this next one, this is a different lady, and I want you to hear a couple minutes of what, you know, she was living her life, very busy, and hear what she did. This is what she did.
A religious liberty attorney and a newly elected school board member to the Carroll Independent School District in Texas. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Hannah, you are an attorney, a mom, a wife. You have a lot going on. So, to think, okay, now I'm going to run for school board. What was it that motivated you to say, this is something I need to do?
Well, you're exactly right. I was really enjoying my life, just being an attorney and being a mom of four active kids and all of the fun things that they do. So life was really good. And then last August, there was a plan that was presented to our school board. It was called the Cultural Competence Action Plan. And it really got me involved in a lot of ways with the school board. Just helping organize and fight back against this plan that wanted to radically change our school district was really, I think, what motivated me to consider running for school board.
So I'm not going to play the whole video, but I will put the link in the podcast website. But basically what I'm trying to show you is that people from all walks of life are speaking out or getting involved. And this lady was obviously very busy already with a job and with four kids. And she saw something that was going to change and teach things that are not true and teach division and not unity. And so she stood up and, you know, and took a stand and ran for school board. So this is kind of what I'm coming from this angle. There's stuff going on. There is attacks coming from all directions on our American Constitutional Republic. They are trying their darndest to destroy it and to tear it down. And it's coming from critical race theory, from Black Lives Matter, from Antifa, burning, looting, rioting, killing, taking over police precincts. You know, it's coming from the government. Absolutely coming from FBI, DOJ, run amok. They are this power-grabbing people that are trampling all over the Constitution and our founding documents. Our founders would be appalled. So it's up to us to stand up and not be silent anymore. So speak out, get involved, go to your Republican Party and get involved and make, you know, be conservative and make changes, you know, because our Republicans are not, they've done some really bad things. They're pretty much cowardly in all of this. They're not standing up and fighting like they should be. And they're just watching it happen. They're part of, some of them are part of this undercover. So it's up to us to make the changes. That's why I do what I do here, try to encourage. Okay, one more example of just running too. I mean, it's time to run. And this is the Lieutenant Governor of North Carolina. I don't want you to hear him. It is fantastic.
That I saw and witnessed it firsthand on television was during 9/11. People running away from those burning buildings, running away in horror. We saw policemen and firemen running to those buildings, basically running to their deaths to go help others because they saw trouble and they knew that they were needed. That's got to be us in this day right here. We've got to run to the trouble, folks. And what is the trouble? The trouble is the Biden administration that is seeking to turn this country into a socialist hellhole. The trouble is Antifa that wants to roam the streets and beat you into submission. The trouble is Black Lives Matter. It claims to care about the lives of black people, but has turned a blind eye while violence in black communities are taking lives at a genocidal rate. They've turned a blind eye. That's where the trouble is, and that's what we've got to run to. And we've got all the right in the world on our side, and there ain't no reason to be afraid. And there ain't no reason to not take the challenge dead on. Because I'm going to tell you who we come from, folks. We don't come from some weak, jellyback, spineless people. That's not who we come from. None of us. And it doesn't matter what color you are, what nation your folks hail from, how much money you got. We all share the same name. We are Americans. And at Bunker Hill, there was Americans. And at Fredericksburg and Gettysburg, there was Americans. And at Iwo Jima, raising that flag on Suribachi, it was Americans. And at Pork Chop Hill, there was Americans. Quezon, there was Americans. And on 9/11, there was Americans who ran towards those burning buildings. That is who you share your heritage with. You do not share your heritage with a weak and ineffective people who cower at the sight of trouble. You share your heritage with a strong and brave people who are determined to hold on to their freedom and for the freedom of future generations. Guys, it's time for us to stand up and be that generation. It's time for us to stand strong and proud and remember who we are, that we are Christians, that we are Americans, that we are Republicans, and that we are conservatives. And as long as we stand as the vanguard of freedom in this nation, freedom will survive here. And not only survive, it will thrive. So guys, it's time to put on our packs. It's time to fix those bayonets. It's time to get ready. Because we got a fight on our hand. And our fight is not for us. It's for all those generations that's going to come behind us. Let's save America, folks. Because if there's to be freedom in this nation in the future, it is only going to become at the behest of the Republican Party, the grand old party, the party of freedom and equality, the one that always has been and the one that always will be. God bless you all. Thank you very much. God bless the great state of North Carolina and God bless the United States of America. Thank you.
Wow, I hope that inspired you like it does me. That was awesome. That was Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson. Is that his name? Yep. Of North Carolina. Woo-wee. That was good. So the last thing I'm going to do is our history. And I am telling you what. I have this new book I'm reading by Patrick K. O'Donnell called The Indispensables. It's a new book he just came out with. And I got it. I saw it on Steve Bannon. And it's the diverse soldier mariners who shaped the country, formed the Navy, and rode Washington across the Delaware. It is fabulous. So far. So I wanted to read this section for our history today to give you an idea of what these people were going through before 1776, kind of what it was building up to. And, you know, there's a lot more before this, obviously a lot more after this chapter, but it's kind of sets a scene of who the people are. And I thought, wow, it's pretty cool. So this is from the book, The Indispensables. And he took 5 years to research all the information for this book because he used original documents. May 13th, 1774, the Boston Harbor. General Thomas Gage, who was the British general, stepped off the HMS Lively, the ship, onto the wharf at Boston. Having returned to England the previous year, he and his family were in London when the colonists hurled tea into the harbor the previous December. Gage returned to become the new military governor of the province of the Massachusetts Bay. The second son of an English nobleman, Gage had married American Margaret Kimball, a great beauty and the social equal of her husband, as the daughter of a wealthy businessman and a descendant of the illustrious Schuyler family. Margaret had well-known sympathies for the colonists. In 1775, she told one gentleman that, quote, she hoped her husband would never be the instrument of sacrificing the lives of her countrymen, end quote. And she is strongly suspected of eventually providing life-saving intelligence to the patriots. During the general's assignment in Boston, the Gages and their 11 children did not reside in the city, but instead were hosted in good friend King Hooper's summer home, an elegant three-story Georgian mansion called the Lindens, in the town of Danvers, closer to Marblehead than to Boston. This book is basically about the citizens of Marblehead, Massachusetts, and how they shaped the American Revolution. In the aftermath of the Boston Tea Party, Parliament had deemed the well-liked 55-year-old general who had served with George Washington during the French and Indian War to be the best replacement for the unpopular Thomas Hutchinson, who had been recalled to London. The British general's unenviable task would be to implement the series of bills passed in March of 1774 that were so extreme in their scope, the colonists labeled them the Intolerable Acts. London called them the Coercive Acts. Designed to punish the Tea Party and bring Massachusetts in line, the new laws abrogated the Charter of Massachusetts, banned most town meetings, formed a new court system, shut down Boston Harbor, and allowed Americans to be tried for crimes in London. Bells tolled on June 1st, 1774, a day the colonists had designated as one of fasting and prayer throughout the colonies, also as a sign of defiance and resistance, when General Gage executed the terms of one of the most egregious of the intolerable acts, the Boston Port Act. He closed Boston Harbor, stationing warships to block all traffic in and out of the port, throwing thousands out of work and starving the city, both literally and economically, until the citizens of Boston could pay for the tea cargo destroyed in the rebels' protest. Later that month, he further dissolved the local government under the authority of the Massachusetts Government Act, eliminating citizens' autonomy, and made himself a virtual dictator. The Justice Act, attacking their right to a fair trial, and the Quartering Act, forcing them to house British soldiers, rounded out the hated pieces of legislation. In instituting the Intolerable Acts, Gage misread the Americans. He advised Parliament that isolating the radicals would squelch the fire of their rebellion. Quote, "America is a mere bully from one end to the other, and the Bostonians by far the greatest bullies," he wrote. On the other hand, as an Englishman, his deep respect for English law led some to criticize the governor as being too lenient in his treatment of the colonists. As Lord Percy wrote, quote, "The general's great lenity and moderation serve only to make them, the colonists, more daring and insolent," end quote. Months later, Edmund Burke observed in his address to Parliament, quote, "In this character of the Americans, a love of freedom is the predominating feature which marks and distinguishes the whole. This fierce spirit of liberty is stronger in the English colonies, probably, than in any of the people of the earth. The temper and character which prevail in our colonies are, I am afraid, unalterable by any human art. We cannot, I fear, falsify the pedigree of this fierce people and persuade them that they are not sprung from a nation in whose veins the blood of freedom circulates." Instead of isolating the radicals as the British hoped, the Intolerable Acts increased sympathy for Boston. Support for the city began to unify the colonies as nothing yet had. If the crown could disenfranchise Massachusetts, none of the colonies were safe. One provision of the punitive Boston Port Act, now largely forgotten, had an enormous potential impact on seaside Marblehead. The act designated Marblehead the primary port of entry for all North American trade by transferring the customs house from Boston to Marblehead. For an indefinite period of time, until British officials judged Boston safe from rebels, Loyalist diarist Ashley Bowen recalled the atmosphere, saying, "There were soldiers planted here in guard boats. Our streets were filled with strange faces in Boston full of British troops. Sad times." This unexpected turn of events forced the citizens of Marblehead to choose between their own immediate prosperity and the common cause of liberty. The citizens of Marblehead rose to the challenge, refusing to profit from the misfortunes of their fellow men. They maintained the embargo on British goods and threw their support behind the city by signing the non-importation agreement regarding goods from Britain that the citizens of Boston requested. This unifying sympathy for the plight of the colonial rebels in Boston catapulted the Whig leaders, Elbridge Gerry, Azor Orne, John Glover, and Jeremiah Lee, back to the forefront of Marblehead politics and neutralized the power of the Loyalists, silencing some of their voices by labeling them traitors and refusing to do business with them. Salem diarist Dr. William Bentley noted the enormous power that the men wielded, saying, "These three men gave a character to Marblehead in the last generation, or for the last 30 years. The leading men had power nowhere else known in New England." Political revolution that flowed from Boston and Marblehead became the zeitgeist, or the spirit of the age, and a majority of colonists in New England supported it. 28 Marblehead merchants went above and beyond, signing the non-importation resolution and offering their wharves and storehouses. Here's what they said. "We hereby offer to our oppressed but much respected brethren of Boston the free use of our stores in this town. We likewise assure them of our readiness in seeing to the lading and unlading of their goods in this town, showing how much we sympathize with and respect them, and we hope to soon to see them relieved from their distress, and the liberties of America founded on a permanent basis by an indissoluble union. One historian noted that the inhabitants of Marblehead tendered the use of their wharves to the Bostonians. One of their number, Elbridge Gerry, the future vice president of America, saying that the resentment of an arbitrary ministry would prove a diadem of honor to the oppressed town. Driven by his sympathy for the Bostonians and the urging of his mentor and friend Samuel Adams and his ever-present fear of uncontrolled centralized power, Gerry devoted himself to the business of distributing the food, supplies, and other goods for the support of the unemployed people of Boston that poured into Marblehead from across the colonies. Across Massachusetts, the rebellious colonists continued to hold town meetings, despite Gage's explicit prohibitions. Quote, whereas by a late act of Parliament, all town meetings called without the consent of the governed are illegal, I do hereby strictly prohibit all persons from attending any meeting not warned by law, as they will be chargeable with all the ill consequences that may follow thereon, and answer the same at their utmost peril. In reaction to their refusal to obey, Gage made a show of force at one Salem meeting in August. Gage assembled troops outside and simultaneously summoned the Patriot leaders to his office in Salem at the time of the meeting. When they admitted to organizing the meeting, he detained them, only to be embarrassed that the next day, when upwards of 3,000 armed men assembled there from adjacent towns with full determination to rescue the committee if they should be sent to prison, warning the governor that if he committed them, Gage must abide by the consequences, for they would not be answerable for what might take place. To back up his proclamations, Gage stationed a regiment of British troops in Salem Neck and Marblehead. The presence of troops caused constant friction. One zealous redcoat bayoneted and wounded Marblehead Captain John Merritt, which caused an immediate outcry from the Americans. Only a swift trial and punishment of the soldier temporarily quelled the unrest. Gage's actions and the incident further emboldened the Americans. The towns through the country are so far from being intimidated that a day in the week does not pass without one or more having meetings in direct contempt of the act, which they regard as a blank piece of paper and not more, wrote Boston merchant John Andrews. They had one directly under his nose at Danvers and continued it 2 or 3 hours longer than necessary to see if Gage would interrupt them. He was acquainted with it, but replied, "Damn 'em! I won't do anything unless it is about His Majesty is about to send me more troops." So, that American spirit is being revived. It's all across the nation, and I'm seeing it in different communities. I've shared a little bit of it today. So, it's up to us. We are the people. We make up the United States of America. We make up this constitutional republic. Doesn't work without us getting involved. We can't just sit back and think it's all going to be okay, that this is all a bad dream or just going to go away. It requires taking action, especially as Christians, taking action and getting involved and getting good people involved, running for office, getting involved in the school board, going to meetings, whatever it is. Just do it. Writing editorials, whatever it is you can do, whatever your talent is and you feel like God would be leading you to do. Hopefully I'm going to be bringing some more stories about this, some people that I know that are getting involved, and I hope to bring those stories to you soon. And thank you for following me, straighttalkwithmj.net, Gab, Straight Talk with MJ, and Telegram, Straight Talk with MJ. So thank you once again. Thanks for listening, and God bless.